Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Sukkot. Yom Kippur is a day apart from the rest of the year, dedicated to tshuva and change. As we hear the final shofar sound, we're blown back from our Yom Kippur existence into our new existence for the rest of the year. Tshuva, as Rabbi Daniel Landy says, is the great turning from our present path to a new one of our own choosing. But as we motor down the highway of life, it can be tough to make a turn, even a small turn, to change lanes. Many of us and our neighbors want our changes for this year to include more Torah study, so here are a few ideas. First, decide that this year will be your year to study Torah in Jerusalem at Pardes. Pardes is dedicated to helping all Jews of all ages, of all backgrounds, to study Torah. Decide and plan now to spend a week, 2 weeks, three or more studying at Pardes this coming summer. If you are anywhere between 18 and 80, Pardes has a course for you during the summer. We can and do arrange special sessions as well, both during the summer and all year round. We host many tour groups who spend a day or two at Pardes, and that time at Pardes is often the most memorable of the trip. Plus, the Pardes chef can provide excellent meals for your group. A second idea is, help your neighbors in their goal of more Torah study by mentioning this Pardes podcast to them. Remember that you can listen to the podcast on any computer, an iPod is not necessary. A lot of people, when they hear podcasts, they think you need an iPod, but you don't. I'll have some more ideas for our next podcast. In this podcast, Rabbi Michael Hatton discusses Sukkot. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a faculty member at Pardes. His focus is Tanakh. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Larry. The Festival of Sukkot. The Torah reading for the Festival of Sukkot is taken from Sefer Vayikra, the Parsha of Emor. The section is read on other festivals as well, the second day of Pesach in particular, outside the land of Israel. The section in Vayikra 23 begins with a mention of the Shabbat. God spoke to Moshe saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, the designated times of God that you shall observe as sacred convocations are the following. For 6 days you shall do work, but on the seventh day it shall be a Sabbath of Sabbaths, a holy convocation. You may not do all manner of work, kol melacha, on it. For it is a Sabbath unto God in all of your habitations." By commencing the section of the holidays with a reference to the Shabbat, the Torah emphasizes the primacy of the latter. For the framework of observances associated with all of the other holidays draws its inspiration directly from the model of the Shabbat. Nevertheless, although in terms of formal external practices the holidays are practically indistinguishable from the Shabbat, there is one critical distinction. Reading the text carefully, we notice that with respect to the Shabbat, the Torah employs a phrase that is not used concerning any other holiday. You may not do kol melacha, any manner of work. And almost all of the other holiday references in our parsha, the Torah prohibits kol melechet avodah, but not kol melacha. Concerning Pesach, the text states, On the first day shall be a holy convocation for you. Kol melechet avodah you shall not do. On Shavuot, you shall declare on that very day a holy convocation. Kol melechet avodah you shall not do. On Rosh Hashanah, you shall not do. Kol melechet avodah. And the first day of Sukkot, as well as the special eighth day convocation associated with that festival, also employs the same language. Kol melechet avodah. While a precise definition of melechet avodah is not provided in the text, clearly, it is some form of labor involving effort. Avodah is often employed by the Torah to signify toil or exertion. On Shabbat, therefore, the Torah rules out all manner of milacha. On the holidays, however, only particular types of milacha, namely those involving avodah or effort, are curtailed. To phrase the matter differently, it follows that on the holidays, certain forms of milacha must therefore be permitted. But which ones? Although our section is silent on the matter, an earlier text from the book of Shemot provides the answer. As the last of the plagues is about to strike, God bids Moshe to tell the people to observe the Passover. This first and most commemorative of the holidays is to be celebrated after liberation from Egypt for all generations as an everlasting decree. Shmot chapter 12, verse 14. On the first and seventh days shall be holy convocations. All manner of work is not to be done on them, kol melacha, only excepting that which is necessary so that people may eat, which may be done by you. Verse 16. Thus the Torah prohibits the execution of work on the holiday, save that which is needed for the preparation of food. Returning to our text, the subtlety of the passage is now clear. On Shabbat, no melacha may be done, including that necessary for food preparation. Provisions for Shabbat must therefore be carried out or commenced ahead of time, for no exemption at all is indicated by the text. On the other holidays, however, although all other forms of melacha are forbidden, food preparation may be done. For as the Ramban points out, work executed for the sake of food preparation is beneficial rather than onerous, in his commentary to Vayikra 23, verse 7. Melechet avodah, or toilsome labor, is therefore prohibited on the holidays, but not ochel nefesh, food for consumption. The Ramban's explanation also addresses the only holiday in our passage that avoids use of this critical phrase. God spoke to Moshe saying, on the 10th day of the 7th month, a day of atonement, a holy convocation, shall be observed by you, on which you shall afflict your souls by fasting. All manner of work, kol melacha, shall not be done on this very day. Vayikra 23:26-28. Why does the Torah say that on Yom Kippur kol melacha shall be curtailed, employing language associated with the Shabbat, rather than employing the phraseology associated with the other holidays? The reason should now be obvious. For since this day is one of fasting, on which no food is to be consumed, the warrant of food preparation does not exist. Consequently, kol melacha is not to be done after the manner of Shabbat. Now turning our attention to the section that describes the holidays, we notice that the Torah commences the discussion with the Passover. This is eminently reasonable, for the Pesach is the very first national festival of our people. These are the set times of God, holy convocations that you shall declare in their proper times. On the 14th day of the first month at eventide shall be Passover unto God. On the 15th day of this month, a holiday of Matzot shall be observed unto God, and for 7 days you shall consume Matzot. Vayikra 23:4-6. The justifications for the observance of the holiday are deeply ingrained historical events surrounding the Exodus. The Passover sacrifice that inaugurated the Day of Redemption, the unleavened bread that so eloquently captured the spirit of servitude and then sudden liberation, are here presented as the central elements of the holiday. No mention is made of the season of the Exodus, although on the morrow of that tumultuous night, Moshe had reminded the people that today you go forth in the month of the spring. Shmot 13, verse 5. In a similar vein, the Torah mandates the celebration of a 7-day festival in the 7th month. On the 15th day of the 7th month, the festival of Sukkot or booths is to be celebrated for 7 days unto God, when you gather in the produce of the land. For 7 days you shall dwell in booths, in order that your descendants will know that in Sukkot I caused the people of Israel to dwell. When I took them out of the land of Egypt, I am God your Lord. Vayikra 23:33-44. Here again, the Torah indicates a binary foundation for the holiday, for it is associated with the agricultural ingathering, as well as with the events of the journey forth from the land of Egypt to traverse the wilderness. Considering the matter from a more general perspective, we notice that Pesach and Sukkot are celebrated at opposite poles of the year. Pesach ushers in the season of the spring, the earnest onset of the growing season. Sukkot falls exactly 6 months later and marks the commencement of fall, as the farmer gathers in the last of his crops from the field, leaves his temporary booth, and begins to look forward to the winter rains. The Torah recognizes and emphasizes these critical agricultural aspects of these festivals, for elsewhere in Scripture they are explicitly connected to their seasonal anchors. With respect to Pesach, the text states, in Shmot 22, verse 15, observe the festival of Matzot, For 7 days you shall eat matzot as I have commanded you in the time of the month of spring, for at that time you left Egypt. Concerning Sukkot, the same section designates it as the festival of the ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in your produce from the field. At the same time, the Torah clearly points out that these holidays have a critical historical character as well. For Pesach celebrates the redemption from Egypt, while Sukkot recalls the journey through the wilderness in the aftermath of the Exodus. What is the significance of this duality, which is underscored in almost every mention of these holidays in the Torah? Why do they commemorate agricultural as well as historical episodes? Examining the issue from another angle, we notice that the dual aspect of these festivals is suggested by the twofold system that is at work for designating their calendar date. On the one hand, these holidays are tethered to the spring and to the fall, two agricultural seasons that are a function of the Earth's revolution around the sun. As the Earth proceeds around the sun with its axis of rotation lying at a slight tilt to the plane of its orbit, the length of the day increases to usher in the season of spring and decreases to announce the onset of fall. In other words, the seasons are completely dependent upon the sun. At the same time, the actual dates of the holidays of Pesach and Sukkot are spelled out in the Torah as the 15th day of the first month and the 15th day of the seventh month, respectively. These time designations are functions not of the sun but of the moon, for the Torah introduces a lunar calendar on the eve of the departure from Egypt. This month shall be for you the first of months, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, Shmot 12, verse 2. As Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra points out, the Torah's consistent use of the term Chodesh to describe month points to a lunar count. The word, he explains, comes from the root Chadash, signifying new, and therefore signifies renewal, for renewal pertains to the light of the moon. Although it has no light of its own, he explains, its appearance waxes and wanes due to the light of the sun. What is singularly striking, however, is that the Torah insists that both of these time systems be employed as the foundation of its calendar. The holidays must fall during their appropriate agricultural seasons, but are formally reckoned according to the phases of the moon. This duality has the potential to create difficulties, for the solar year, that is, the period of a single complete rotation of the earth around the sun, is approximately 365 1/4 days long, while a period of 12 lunar months is approximately 354 days long. This is because each lunar month describes a complete revolution of the moon around the earth and constitutes about 29 1/2 days. It should be emphasized that both systems are actually completely independent, for the periods of the moon have absolutely nothing to do with the rotation of the earth around the sun. The fact that we tend to speak of 12 months in a year is arbitrary, and is based upon an early recognition that over the course of a solar year, approximately 12 lunar renewals would be observed. For the sake of comparison, note that the English word month is itself derived also from the Old English word for moon. The method of synchronizing the seasons of the sun with the months of the moon is the basis of the Jewish calendar, and explains the periodic introduction of a 13th month to harmonize the discrepancy, as in the present calendar year. We may contrast this system with a completely solar calendar employed in all countries historically associated with Christianity. The seasons always begin on the same calendar day of the year. Or the exclusively lunar calendar used in all Muslim countries, so that Muslim festivals over the course of time migrate across the seasons of the year. We therefore notice that the Torah unerringly refers to Pesach as associated with the time of spring and Sukkot as the festival of the fall. These designations are seasonally dependent and relate to the sun. At the same time, the Torah is always careful to recall the historical basis of these festivals, to set their formal dates as a function of lunar months that, strictly speaking, are completely independent of the agricultural seasons. What is the significance of this duality? Early on in human development, mankind recognized that survival was a function of the seasons. The gracious rays of the sun warmed the earth, the welcome rains revived it, and it in turn brought forth its bounty. When cultivated conscientiously, its black soil could miraculously transform seeds into sustenance. But there were other awesome and capricious forces at work, for an unexpected period of intense heat could burn up its beneficence, and an unforeseen storm could swiftly sweep it away. Thus, early man, seeking to relieve himself of the existential tension of his predicament, thought it prudent to seek the favor of these natural forces, whom he primitively identified with different divinities. The forces of nature were worshipped as gods, and these were perceived as at once terrifying in their power, but also munificent in their life-giving support. The Torah forcefully parted ways with this conception of the world, by proclaiming in absolute terms that a single God had fashioned the cosmos and continued to sustain it. The forces of nature were not erratic and mercurial gods at odds with each other, but rather the manifestations of an underlying structure to a universe that had been called into being by a willful creator. The seasons, paradigms for these manifold powers of nature, were themselves functions of the sun, the most majestic and mighty force of them all. But even the sun and all of its host were, the Torah explained, not gods in their own right, but only the effortless work of an absolute being and consequently subject to his rule. How difficult it is for us to imagine the spiritual state of humanity 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. We take for granted that we live in a world that has already progressed to a theological conception of the universe not that far from the opening verses of Bereshit. At that time, and for many, many centuries afterwards, however, the Torah's towering message must have seemed astonishing and surreal. Thus, the holidays of spring and fall, celebrated by humanity from time immemorial as pivotal events in the life of the gods, were henceforth to be observed as expressions of the single Creator's omnipotence. Pesach and Sukkot proclaimed God's complete mastery over nature, his indispensable involvement in the processes of cultivation and harvest, growth and decay, life and death itself. The Torah enjoined festivals broadcast for the first time the revolutionary message that the contradictory forces of the cosmos, though they might seem awesome and overwhelming, were themselves entirely under the dominion of a singular non-corporeal God, who transcended the inherent limitations of matter that held the lesser divinities in sway. But that was not enough. For a God of nature, mighty as he might be, was not necessarily a God involved, a God immediate, or a God who cared. The transcendence of an absolute deity could easily be mistaken for remoteness, his otherworldliness for abstraction. The forces of creation might be breathtaking in their grandeur and awesome in their intensity, but they were also, by the very same token, impersonal in their expanse. The seasons progressed at their own pace, seemingly indifferent to any human cares and apparently unheeding of our concerns. "I am God, your Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt," thundered the deity at Sinai, articulating for the first time in the history of the world the notion of a God that was aware, attentive, near at hand, and involved. This was a God who was aware of oppression, attentive to the cries of those in servitude, near to their pain, and intimately involved in their liberation. The Exodus was not in the main about a God who could overpower, but about a God who could redeem. Human destiny was no longer to be regarded as being subject to the impersonal fates, but was rather proclaimed to be a function of human conduct and human choices. The gods could be bought off with incantations and bribed with offerings, but the God of Israel could only be supplicated with deeds of kindness and acts of compassion. The gods of Egypt, among whom the Pharaoh occupied an honored position, could easily countenance the injustice of a groaning humanity enslaved in cruel bondage, for they were not particularly concerned with human destiny, and, themselves subject to an irresistible fate, were anywise powerless to affect it. With the same suddenness as the act of creation, this new understanding burst forth on the world, carried forward by a freed people of Israel, still too spiritually inchoate to fully internalize its significance. In order to impress it upon them, they were given new observances to commemorate the great historical events that surrounded their deliverance, to recall God's intimate involvement and ongoing concern that had brought them forth from Egypt and sustained them during the course of their wanderings. There was thus an intrinsic aspect to these events that did not relate to the seasons of the year at all, to the events of nature or to the cycles of agriculture, but only to the unique relationship between God and man. This was a facet particular to humanity. It did not seek to address the larger framework of a cosmos that was by definition transcendent and impersonal. It was an aspect that was best expressed by coupling it to the phases of the moon. For the lunar calendar, in contrast to its solar counterpart, was about man's history and his life. If the seasons of the sun are about God's mastery of nature, the phases of the moon are about man's imprint on time. The solar seasons have their own rhythms that unfold independent of our existence, but the lunar calendar is artificial and contrived. It is an expression of how we mark time as human beings and gauge the progress of our lives. For according to astronomical reality, there is no such thing as a lunar year. We create the artifice of a lunar year. We assign it validity, for its conventions are products of our ingenuity. By remembering the historical and momentous events of our national birth according to a lunar reckoning, we celebrate man's role in the world, and especially his privileged status as the most precious subject of God's concern. The solar calendar is about God's involvement with the world, but the lunar calendar is about God's involvement with man. By dating the holidays of the Exodus and the wilderness according to the lunar cycle, the Torah is insisting that we remain cognizant of God's other aspect of connectedness, his immediacy and intimacy, his ongoing involvement in the ebb and tide of our unfolding human lives. There is a God of creation, but there is also a God of history. The revolution that the Torah unleashed was the idea that these two fundamental aspects are in truth a perfect oneness that is inseparable. Thus, Pesach is the holiday of the spring, but also the season of our redemption from Egypt. Sukkot celebrates the harvest, but also recalls our traversing of the hostile wilderness. The seasons of the sun and the phases of the moon must be synchronized, for they speak of a unified idea that alone has the power to transform us. Most of us are probably comfortable with the notion of a creator, even perhaps an all-powerful one, but we would prefer to keep him at arm's length. God may have created the cosmos, but, we surmise with relief, he has fortunately receded into the shadows of time, transcendent, absolute, but irrelevant. Conceptually, not much separates the notion of no God from the notion of an unaware, uncaring, and removed God, for the impact on our lives is practically negligible in either case. Only the idea of an omnipotent and concerned God, who is capable but who also demands, who is strong enough to intervene but who also takes account, who nurtures but at the same time obligates us to grow, can make a difference in our lives. This then is the true significance of Pesach and Sukkot, the festivals not only of the fruits of the soil, but of the fruits of the soul as well.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Hag Sameach, enjoy Sukkot, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Pardes from Jerusalem. If you have any comments, please let us know at podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks again, and I'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.